The Hobbit, Disc 8.
They had barely time to fly back to the tunnel, pulling and dragging in their bundles, when Smaug came hurtling from the north, licking the mountain sides with flame, beating his great wings with a noise like a roaring wind. His hot breath shriveled the grass before the door and drove in through the crack they had left and scorched them as they lay hid. Flickering fires leapt up and black rock shadows danced. Then darkness fell as he passed again. The ponies screamed with terror, burst their ropes and galloped wildly off. The dragon swooped and turned to pursue them and was gone.
"That'll be the end of our poor beasts," said Thorin. "Nothing can escape Smaug once he sees it. Here we are, and here we shall have to stay, unless anyone fancies tramping the long open miles back to the river with Smaug on the watch."
It was not a pleasant thought. They crept further down the tunnel, and there they lay and shivered, though it was warm and stuffy, until dawn came pale through the crack of the door. Every now and again, through the night, they could hear the roar of the flying dragon grow and then pass and fade as he hunted round and round the mountainsides. He guessed from the ponies and from the traces of the camps he had discovered that men had come up from the river and the lake and had scaled the mountainside from the valley where the ponies had been standing. But the door withstood his searching eye, and the little high-walled bay had kept out his fiercest flames. Long he had hunted in vain till the dawn chilled his wrath, and he went back to his golden couch to sleep and to gather new strength. He would not forget or forgive the theft, not if 1,000 years turned him to smouldering stone, but he could afford to wait. Slow and silent he crept back to his lair and half closed his eyes. When morning came, the terror of the dwarves grew less. They realized that dangers of this kind were inevitable in dealing with such a guardian, and that it was no good giving up their quest yet. Nor could they get away just now, as Thorin had pointed out. Their ponies were lost or killed, and they would have to wait some time before Smaug relaxed his watch sufficiently for them to dare the long way on foot. Luckily, they had saved enough of their stores to last them still for some time. They debated long on what was to be done, but they could think of no way of getting rid of Smaug, which had always been a weak point in their plans, as Bilbo felt inclined to point out. Then, as is the nature of folk that are thoroughly perplexed, they began to grumble at the Hobbit, blaming him for what had at first so pleased them, for bringing away a cup and stirring up Smaug's wrath so soon. "What else do you suppose a burglar is to do?" asked Bilbo angrily. "I was not engaged to kill dragons, that is warrior's work, but to steal treasure. I made the best beginning I could. Did you expect me to trot back with a whole hoard of thrall on my back? If there's any grumbling to be done, I think I might have a say. You ought to have brought 500 burglars, not one. I'm sure it reflects great credit on your grandfather, but you cannot pretend that you ever made the vast extent of his wealth clear to me. I should want hundreds of years to bring it all up, if I was 50 times as big and Smaug as tame as a rabbit." After that, of course, the dwarves begged his pardon.
"What then do you propose we should do, Mr. Baggins?" asked Thorin politely.
"I have no idea at the moment, if you mean about removing the treasure. That obviously depends entirely on some new turn of luck and the getting rid of Smaug. Getting rid of dragons is not at all in my line, but I'll do my best to think about it. Personally, I have no hopes at all, and wish I was safe back at home."
"Never mind that for the moment. What are we to do now, today?"
"Well,
if you really want my advice, I should say we can do nothing but stay where we are. By day we can no doubt creep out safely enough to take the air. Perhaps before long one or two could be chosen to go back to the store by the river and replenish our supplies. But in the meanwhile, everyone ought to be well inside the tunnel by night. Now, I will make you an offer. I have got my ring and will creep down this very noon. Then, if ever, Smaug ought to be napping, and see what he's up to. Perhaps something will turn up. Every worm has his weak spot, as my father used to say, though I'm sure it was not from personal experience. Naturally, the dwarves accepted the offer eagerly. Already they had come to respect little Bilbo. Now he had become the real leader in their adventure. He had begun to have ideas and plans of his own. When midday came, he got ready for another journey down into the mountain. He didn't like it, of course, but it wasn't so bad now he knew, more or less, what was in front of him. Had he known more about dragons and their wily ways, he might have been more frightened and less hopeful of catching this one napping. The sun was shining when he started, but it was as dark as night in the tunnel. The light from the door, almost closed, soon faded as he went down. So silent was his going that smoke on a gentle wind could hardly have surpassed it, and he was inclined to feel a bit proud of himself as he drew near the lower door. There was only the very faintest glow to be seen. "Old Smaug is weary and asleep," he thought. "He can't see me, and he won't hear me. Cheer up, Bilbo." He had forgotten, or had never heard about dragons' sense of smell. It is also an awkward fact that they keep half an eye open watching while they sleep, if they are suspicious. Smaug certainly looked fast asleep, almost dead and dark, with scarcely a snore more than a whiff of unseen steam, when Bilbo peeped once more from the entrance. He was just about to step out onto the floor when he caught a sudden thin and piercing ray of red from under the drooping lid of Smaug's left eye. He was only pretending to sleep. He was watching the tunnel entrance. Hurriedly Bilbo stepped back and blessed the luck of his ring. Then Smaug spoke.
"Well, thief, I smell you and I feel your air. I hear your breath. Come along, help yourself again. There is plenty and to spare."
But Bilbo was not quite so unlearned in dragon lore as all that, and if Smaug hoped to get him to come nearer so easily, he was disappointed. "No, thank you, O Smaug the Tremendous," he replied. "I did not come for presents. I only wished to have a look at you and see if you were truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them."
"Do you now?"
said the dragon, somewhat flattered, even though he did not believe a word of it.
"Truly, songs and tales fall utterly short of the reality, O Smaug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities," replied Bilbo.
"You have nice manners for a thief and a liar," said the dragon. "You seem familiar with my name, but I don't seem to remember smelling you before. Who are you, and where do you come from, may I ask?"
"You may indeed. I come from under the hill, and under the hills and over the hills my paths led, and through the air I am he that walks unseen."
"So I can well believe," said Smaug, But that is hardly your usual name.
I am the clue finder, the web cutter, the stinging fly. I was chosen for the lucky number.
Lovely titles, sneered the dragon. But lucky numbers don't always come off.
I am he that buries his friends alive and drowns them and draws them alive again from the water. I came from the end of a bag, but no bag went over me.
These don't sound so creditable, scoffed Smaug.
I am the friend of bears and the guest of eagles. I am ring-winner and luck-wearer, and I am barrel-rider, went on Bilbo, beginning to be pleased with his riddling.
That's better, said Smaug, but don't let your imagination run away with you.
This, of course, is the way to talk to dragons, if you don't want to reveal your proper name, which is wise, and don't want to infuriate them by a flat refusal, which is also very wise. No dragon can resist the fascination of riddling talk and of wasting time trying to understand it. There was a lot here which Smaug did not understand at all, though I expect you do, since you know all about Bilbo's adventures to which he was referring. But he thought he understood enough, and he chuckled in his wicked inside.
I thought so last night, he smiled to himself. Lakemen, some nasty scheme of those miserable tub-trading lakemen, or I'm a lizard. I haven't been down that way for an age and an age, but I will soon alter that. Very well, O Barrel Rider, he said aloud. Maybe Barrel was your pony's name, and maybe not, though it was fat enough. You may walk unseen, but you did not walk all the way. Let me tell you, I ate 6 ponies last night. And I shall catch and eat all the others before long. In return for the excellent meal, I will give you 1 piece of advice for your good. Don't have more to do with dwarves than you can help.
Dwarves? Said Bilbo in pretended surprise.
Don't talk to me, said Smaug. I know the smell and taste of dwarf. No one better. Don't tell me that I can eat a dwarf-ridden pony and not know it. You'll come to a bad end if you go with such friends, thief barrel rider. I don't mind if you go back and tell them so from me.
But he did not tell Bilbo that there was 1 smell he could not make out at all, hobbit smell. It was quite outside his experience and puzzled him mightily.
I suppose you got a fair price for that cup last night, he went on. Come now, did you? Nothing at all? Well, that's just like them. And I suppose they are skulking outside, and your job is to do all the dangerous work and get what you can when I'm not looking for them. And you will get a fair share. Don't you believe it? If you get off alive, you will be lucky.
Bilbo was now beginning to feel really uncomfortable. Whenever Smaug's roving eye, seeking for him in the shadows, flashed across him, he trembled, and an unaccountable desire seized hold of him to rush out and reveal himself and tell all the truth to Smaug. In fact, he was in grievous danger of coming under the dragon spell. But plucking up courage, he spoke again. "You don't know everything, O Smaug the Mighty," said he. "Not gold alone brought us hither."
"Ha, ha, you admit the us," laughed Smaug. "Why not say us 14 and be done with it, Mr. Lucky Number? I am pleased to hear that you had other business in these parts besides my gold. In that case, you may perhaps not altogether waste your time. I don't know if it has occurred to you that, even if you could steal the gold bit by bit, a matter of 100 years or so, you could not get it very far. Not much use on the mountainside. Not much use in the forest. Bless me, had you never thought of the catch? A 14th share, I suppose, or something like it. Those were the terms, eh? But what about delivery? What about cartage? What about armed guards and tolls?"
And Smaug laughed aloud. He had a wicked and a wily heart, and he knew his guesses were not far out, though he suspected that the lake men were at the back of the plans, and that most of the plunder was meant to stop there in the town by the shore that in his young days had been called Esgaroth. You will hardly believe it, but poor Bilbo was really very taken aback. So far all his thoughts and energies had been concentrated on getting to the mountain and finding the entrance. He had never bothered to wonder how the treasure was to be removed, certainly never how any part of it that might fall to his share was to be brought back all the way to Bag End Underhill. Now a nasty suspicion began to grow in his mind. Had the dwarves forgotten this important point too, or were they laughing in their sleeves at him all the time? That is the effect that dragon talk has on the inexperienced. Bilbo, of course, ought to have been on his guard, but Smaug had rather an overwhelming personality. "I tell you," he said, in an effort to remain loyal to his friends and to keep his end up, "that gold was only an afterthought with us. We came over hill and under hill, by wave and wind, for revenge. Surely, O Smaug the unassessably wealthy, you must realize that your success has made you some bitter enemies." Then Smaug really did laugh, a devastating sound which shook Bilbo to the floor, while far up in the tunnel the dwarves huddled together and imagined that the hobbit had come to a sudden and a nasty end.
"Revenge!" he snorted,
and the light of his eyes lit the hall from floor to ceiling like scarlet lightning.
"Revenge! The king under the mountain is dead, and where are his kin that dare seek revenge? Geryon, lord of Dale, is dead, and I have eaten his people like a wolf among sheep. And where are his sons' sons that dare approach me? I kill where I wish, and none dare resist. I laid low the warriors of old, and their like is not in the world today. Then I was but young and tender. Now I am old and strong, strong, strong. Thief in the shadows," he gloated. "My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are swords. My claws, spears. The shock of my tail is a thunderbolt. My wings, a hurricane. And my breath, death."
"I have always understood," said Bilbo in a frightened squeak, "that dragons were softer underneath, especially in the region of the chest. But doubtless one so fortified has thought of that." The dragon stopped short in his boasting.
"Your information is antiquated," he snapped. "I am armored above and below with iron scales and hard gems, No blade can pierce me.
I might have guessed it, said Bilbo. Truly there can nowhere be found the equal of Lord Smaug the Impenetrable. What magnificence to possess a waistcoat of fine diamonds!
Yes, it is rare and wonderful indeed, said Smaug, absurdly pleased.
He did not know that the hobbit had already caught a glimpse of his peculiar undercovering on his previous visit, and was itching for a closer view, for reasons of his own. The dragon rolled over.
Look, he said. What do you say to that?
Dazzlingly marvellous. Perfect. Flawless. Staggering, exclaimed Bilbo aloud. But what he thought inside was, old fool, why, there is a large patch in the hollow of his left breast, as bare as a snail out of its shell.
After he had seen that, Mr. Baggins' one idea was to get away.
Well, I really must not detain your magnificence any longer, he said, or keep you from your much-needed rest. Ponies take some catching, I believe, after a long start. And so do burglars, he added as a parting shot, as he darted back and fled up the tunnel.
It was an unfortunate remark, for the dragon spouted terrific flames after him, and fast though he sped up the slope, he had not gone nearly far enough to be comfortable before the ghastly head of Smaug was thrust against the opening behind. Luckily the whole head and jaws could not squeeze in, but the nostrils sent forth fire and vapour to pursue him, and he was nearly overcome, and stumbled blindly on in great pain and fear. He had been feeling rather pleased with the cleverness of his conversation with Smaug, but his mistake at the end shook him into better sense.
"Never laugh at live dragons, Bilbo, you fool," he said to himself,
and it became a favourite saying of his later, and passed into a proverb.
"You aren't nearly through this adventure yet," he added,
and that was pretty true as well. The afternoon was turning into evening when he came out again and stumbled and fell in a faint on the doorstep. The dwarves revived him and doctored his scorches as well as they could, but it was a long time before the hair on the back of his head and his heels grew properly again. It had all been singed and frizzled right down to the skin. In the meanwhile, his friends did their best to cheer him up, and they were eager for his story, especially wanting to know why the dragon had made such an awful noise, and how Bilbo had escaped. But the hobbit was worried and uncomfortable, and they had difficulty in getting anything out of him. On thinking things over, he was now regretting some of the things he had said to the dragon, and was not eager to repeat them. The old thrush was sitting on a rock nearby, with his head cocked on one side, listening to all that was said. It shows what an ill temper Bilbo was in. He picked up a stone and threw it at the thrush, which merely fluttered aside and came back.
"Drat the bird," said Bilbo crossly. "I believe he's listening, and I don't like the look of him."
"Leave him alone," said Thorin. "The thrushes are good and friendly. This is a very old bird indeed, and is maybe the last left of the ancient breed that used to live about here, tamed to the hands of my father and grandfather. They were a long-lived and magical race, and this might even be one of those that were alive then, a couple of hundreds of years or more ago. The men of Dale used to have the trick of understanding their language, and used them for messengers to fly to the men of the lake and elsewhere."
"Well, he'll have news to take to Lake Town all right, if that is what he's after," said Bilbo. "Though I don't suppose there are any people left there that trouble with thrush language."
"Why, what has happened?" cried the dwarves. "Do get on with your tale."
So Bilbo told them all he could remember, and he confessed that he had a nasty feeling that the dragon guessed too much from his riddles added to the camps and the ponies. I'm sure he knows we came from Lake Town and had help from there, and I have a horrible feeling that his next move may be in that direction. I wish to goodness I'd never said that about Barrel Rider. It would make even a blind rabbit in these parts think of the lake men.
Well, well, it can't be helped, and it's difficult not to slip in talking to a dragon, or so I've always heard, said Balin, anxious to comfort him. I think you did very well, if you ask me. You found out one very useful thing at any rate, and got home alive, and that's more than most can say who've had words with the likes of Smaug. It may be a mercy and a blessing yet to know of the bare patch in the old worm's diamond waistcoat.
That turned the conversation, and they all began discussing dragon slayings historical, dubious, and mythical, and the various sorts of stabs and jabs and undercuts, and the different arts, devices, and stratagems by which they had been accomplished. The general opinion was that catching a dragon napping was not as easy as it sounded, and the attempt to stick one or prod one asleep was more likely to end in disaster than a bold frontal attack. All the while they talked, the thrush listened, till at last, when the stars began to peep forth, it silently spread its wings and flew away. And all the while they talked and the shadows lengthened, Bilbo became more and more unhappy, and his foreboding grew. At last he interrupted them. "I'm sure we're very unsafe here," he said, "and I don't see the point of sitting here. The dragon has withered all the pleasant green, and anyway the night has come and it's cold. But I feel it in my bones that this place will be attacked again. Smaug knows now how I came down to his hall, and you can trust him to guess where the other end of the tunnel is. He will break all this side of the mountain to bits, if necessary, to stop up our entrance, and if we're smashed with it, the better he will like it."
"You are very gloomy, Mr. Baggins," said Thorin. "Why has not Smaug blocked the lower end, then, if he's so eager to keep us out? He has not, or we should have heard him."
I don't know, because at first he wanted to try and lure me in again, I suppose, and now perhaps because he's waiting till after tonight's hunt, or because he does not want to damage his bedroom if he can help it. But I wish you would not argue. Smaug will be coming out at any minute now, and our only hope is to get well in the tunnel and shut the door."
He seemed so much in earnest that the dwarves at last did as he said, though they delayed shutting the door. It seemed a desperate plan, for no one knew whether or how they could get it open again from the inside, and the thought of being shut in a place from which the only way out led through the dragon's lair was not one they liked. Also, everything seemed quite quiet, both outside and down the tunnel. So for a longish while they sat inside, not far down from the half-open door, and went on talking. The talk turned to the dragon's wicked words about the dwarves. Bilbo wished he had never heard them, or at least that he could feel quite certain that the dwarves now were absolutely honest when they declared that they had never thought at all about what would happen after the treasure had been won.
"We knew it would be a desperate venture," said Thorin, "and we know that still. And I still think that when we have won it, we'll be time enough to think what to do about it. As for your share, Mr. Baggins, I assure you we are more than grateful, and you shall choose your own 14th as soon as we have anything to divide. I'm sorry if you're worried about transport, and I admit the difficulties are great. The lands have not become less wild with the passing of time, rather the reverse. But we will do whatever we can for you, and take our share of the cost when the time comes. Believe me or not, as you like."
From that the talk turned to the great hoard itself, and to the things that Thorin and Balin remembered.
They wondered if they were still lying there, unharmed in the hall below. The spears that were made for the armies of the great King Bloodorthin, long since dead, each had a thrice-forged head, and their shafts were inlaid with cunning gold, but they were never delivered or paid for. Shields made for warriors long dead, the great golden cup of Thror, two-handed, hammered and carven with birds and flowers, whose eyes and petals were of jewels. Coats of mail gilded and silvered and impenetrable. The necklace of Geryon, Lord of Dale, made of 500 emeralds green as grass, which he gave for the arming of his eldest son, in a coat of dwarf-linked rings, the like of which had never been made before, for it was wrought of pure silver to the power and strength of triple steel. But fairest of all was the great white gem, which the dwarves had found beneath the roots of the mountain, the heart of the mountain, the Arkenstone of Thrain.
The Arkenstone, the Arkenstone, murmured Thorin in the dark, half dreaming with his chin upon his knees. It was like a globe with a thousand facets. It shone like silver in the firelight, like water in the sun, like snow under the stars, like rain upon the moon.
But the enchanted desire of the hoard had fallen from Bilbo. All through their talk, he was only half listening to them. He sat nearest to the door, with one ear cocked for any beginnings of a sound without. His other was alert for echoes beyond the murmurs of the dwarves, for any whisper of a movement from far below. Darkness grew deeper, and he grew ever more uneasy. "Shut the door," he begged them. "I fear that dragon in my marrow. I like this silence far less than the uproar of last night. Shut the door before it's too late." Something in his voice gave the dwarves an uncomfortable feeling. Slowly Thorin shook off his dreams, and getting up he kicked away the stone that wedged the door. Then they thrust upon it, and it closed with a snap and a clang. No trace of a keyhole was there left on the inside. They were shut in the mountain. And not a moment too soon. They had hardly gone any distance down the tunnel when a blow smote the side of the mountain like the crash of battering rams made of forest oaks and swung by giants. The rock boomed, the walls cracked, and stones fell from the roof on their heads. What would have happened if the door had still been open, I don't like to think. They fled further down the tunnel, glad to be still alive, while behind them, outside, they heard the roar and rumble of Smaug's fury. He was breaking rocks to pieces, smashing wall and cliff with the lashings of his huge tail, till their little lofty camping ground, the scorched grass, the thrush's stone, the snail-covered walls, the narrow ledge, and all disappeared in a jumble of smithereens, and an avalanche of splintered stones fell over the cliff into the valley below. Smaug had left his lair in silent stealth, quietly soared into the air, and then floated heavy and slow in the dark like a monstrous crow down the wind towards the west of the mountain, in the hopes of catching unawares something or somebody there, and of spying the outlet to the passage which the thief had used. This was the outburst of his wrath, when he could find nobody and see nothing, even where he guessed the outlet must actually be. After he had let off his rage in this way, he felt better, and he thought in his heart that he would not be troubled again from that direction. In the meanwhile he had further vengeance to take.
"Barrel rider," he snorted.
Chapter 13.
not at home. In the meanwhile, the dwarves sat in darkness, and utter silence fell about them. Little they ate, and little they spoke. They could not count the passing time, and they scarcely dared to move, for the whisper of their voices echoed and rustled in the tunnel. If they dozed, they woke still to darkness and to silence going on unbroken. At last, after days and days of waiting, as it seemed, when they were becoming choked and dazed for want of air, they could bear it no longer. They would almost have welcomed sounds from below of the dragon's return. In the silence they feared some cunning devilry of his, but they could not sit there for ever. Thorin spoke.
"Let us try the door," he said. "I must feel the wind on my face soon or die. I think I would rather be smashed by Smaug in the open than suffocate in here."
So several of the dwarves got up and groped back to where the door had been. But they found that the upper end of the tunnel had been shattered and blocked with broken rock. Neither key nor the magic it had once obeyed would ever open that door again.
"We are trapped," they groaned. "This is the end. We shall die here."
But somehow, just when the dwarves were most despairing, Bilbo felt a strange lightening of the heart, as if a heavy weight had gone from under his waistcoat. "Come, come," he said. "While there's life, there's hope, as my father used to say, and third time pays for all. I'm going down the tunnel once again. I've been that way twice, when I knew there was a dragon at the other end, so I'll risk a third visit when I'm no longer sure. Anyway, the only way out is down, and I think this time you'd better all come with me." In desperation they agreed, and Thorin was the first to go forward by Bilbo's side. "Now do be careful," whispered the hobbit, "and as quiet as you can be. There may be no Smaug at the bottom, but then again there may be. Don't let us take any unnecessary risks." Down, down they went. The dwarves could not, of course, compare with the hobbit in real stealth, and they made a deal of puffing and shuffling, which echoes magnified alarmingly. But though every now and again Bilbo, in fear, stopped and listened, not a sound stirred below. Near the bottom, as well as he could judge, Bilbo slipped on his ring and went ahead. But he did not need it. The darkness was complete, and they were all invisible, ring or no ring. In fact, so black was it that the hobbit came to the opening unexpectedly, put his hand on air, stumbled forward, and rolled headlong into the hall. There he lay face downwards on the floor and did not dare to get up, or hardly even to breathe. But nothing moved. There was not a gleam of light, unless, as it seemed to him, when at last he slowly raised his head, there was a pale white glint above him and far off in the gloom. But certainly it was not a spark of dragon fire, though the worm stench was heavy in the place and the taste of vapour was on his tongue. At length Mr. Baggins could bear it no longer. "Confound you, Smaug, you worm!" he squeaked aloud. "Stop playing hide-and-seek. Give me a light, and then eat me, if you can catch me." Faint echoes ran round the unseen hall, but there was no answer. Bilbo got up and found that he did not know in what direction to turn. "Now I wonder what on earth Smaug is playing at," he said. "He's not at home today, or tonight, or whatever it is, I do believe. If Oin and Gloin have not lost their tinder-boxes, perhaps we can make a little light and have a look round before the luck turns." "Light!" he cried. "Could anybody make a light?" The dwarves, of course, were very alarmed when Bilbo fell forward down the step with a bump into the hall and they sat huddled just where he had left them at the end of the tunnel. "Shh! Shh!" they hissed when they heard his voice. And though that helped the hobbit to find out where they were, it was some time before he could get anything else out of them. But in the end, when Bilbo actually began to stamp on the floor and screamed out, "Light!" at the top of his shrill voice, Thorin gave way, and Oin and Gloin were sent back to their bundles at the top of the tunnel. After a while, a twinkling gleam showed them returning. Oin with a small pine torch, a light in his hand, and Gloin with a bundle of others under his arm. Quickly Bilbo trotted to the door and took the torch, but he could not persuade the dwarves to light the others or to come and join him yet. As Thorin carefully explained, Mr. Baggins was still officially their expert burglar and investigator. If he liked to risk a light, that was his affair. They would wait in the tunnel for his report. So they sat near the door and watched. They saw the little dark shape of the hobbit start across the floor, holding his tiny light aloft. Every now and again, while he was still near enough, they caught a glint and a tinkle as he stumbled on some golden thing. The light grew smaller as he wandered away into the vast hall. Then it began to rise, dancing into the air. Bilbo was climbing the great mound of treasure. Soon he stood upon the top and still went on. Then they saw him halt and stoop for a moment. But they did not know the reason. It was the Arkenstone, the heart of the mountain. So Bilbo guessed from Thorin's description. But indeed, there could not be two such gems, even in so marvellous a hoard, even in all the world. Ever as he climbed, the same white gleam had shone before him and drawn his feet towards it. Slowly it grew to a little globe of pallid light. Now, as he came near, it was tinged with a flickering sparkle of many colours at the surface, reflected and splintered from the wavering light of his torch. At last he looked down upon it, and he caught his breath. The great jewel shone before his feet of its own inner light, and yet, cut and fashioned by the dwarves, who had dug it from the heart of the mountain long ago, it took all light that fell upon it and changed it into 10,000 sparks of white radiance shot with glints of the rainbow. Suddenly Bilbo's arm went towards it, drawn by its enchantment. His small hand would not close about it, for it was a large and heavy gem. But he lifted it, shut his eyes, and put it in his deepest pocket. "Now I am a burglar indeed," thought he. "But I suppose I must tell the dwarves about it, sometime. They did say I could pick and choose my own share, and I think I'd choose this if they took all the rest." All the same, he had an uncomfortable feeling that the picking and choosing had not really been meant to include this marvellous gem, and that trouble would yet come of it. Now he went on again. Down the other side of the great mound he climbed, and the spark of his torch vanished from the sight of the watching dwarves. But soon they saw it far away in the distance again. Bilbo was crossing the floor of the hall. He went on until he came to the great doors at the further side, and there a draught of air refreshed him, but it almost puffed out his light. He peeped timidly through and caught a glimpse of great passages and of the dim beginnings of wide stairs going up into the gloom. And still there was no sight nor sound of Smaug. He was just going to turn and go back when a black shape swooped at him and brushed his face. He squeaked and started, stumbled backwards and fell. His torch dropped head downwards and went out. "Only a bat, I suppose and hope, he said miserably. But now what am I to do? Which is east, south, north, or west? Thorin, Balin, Oin, Gloin, Feely, Keely, he cried as loud as he could. It seemed a thin little noise in the wide blackness. The light's gone out. Someone come and find me and help me. For the moment his courage had failed altogether. Faintly the dwarves heard his small cries, though the only word they could catch was, Help!
Now what on earth or under it has happened? Said Thorin. Certainly not the dragon, or he would not go on squeaking.
They waited a moment or two, and still there were no dragon noises, no sound at all, in fact, but Bilbo's distant voice.
Come, one of you, get another light or two, Thorin ordered. It seems we've got to go and help our burglar.
It's about our turn to help, said Balin, and I'm quite willing to go. Anyway, I expect it's safe for the moment.
Gloin lit several more torches, and then they all crept out, one by one, and went along the wall as hurriedly as they could. It was not long before they met Bilbo himself, coming back towards them. His wits had quickly returned as soon as he saw the twinkle of their lights.
Only a bat and a dropped torch, nothing worse, he said in answer to their questions.
Though they were much relieved, they were inclined to be grumpy at being frightened for nothing. But what they would have said, if he had told them at that moment about the Arkenstone, I don't know. The mere fleeting glimpses of treasure, which they had caught as they went along, had rekindled all the fire of their dwarvish hearts. And when the heart of a dwarf, even the most respectable, is wakened by gold and by jewels, he grows suddenly bold, and he may become fierce. The dwarves, indeed, no longer needed any urging. All were now eager to explore the hall while they had the chance, and willing to believe that, for the present, Smaug was away from home. Each now gripped a lighted torch, and as they gazed, first on one side and then on another, they forgot fear and even caution. They spoke aloud, and cried one to another, as they lifted old treasures from the mound or from the wall, and held them in the light, caressing and fingering them. Feely and Keely were almost in merry mood, and finding, still hanging there, many golden harps strung with silver, they took them and struck them, and being magical, and also untouched by the dragon, who had small interest in music, they were still in tune. The dark hall was filled with a melody that had long been silent, but most of the dwarves were more practical. They gathered gems and stuffed their pockets, and let what they could not carry fall back through their fingers with a sigh. Thorin was not least among these, but always he searched from side to side for something which he could not find. It was the Arkenstone. But he spoke of it yet to no one. Now the dwarves took down mail and weapons from the walls and armed themselves. Royal indeed did Thorin look, clad in a coat of gold-plated rings, with a silver-hafted axe in a belt crusted with scarlet stones.
"Mr. Baggins," he cried, "here is the first payment of your reward. Cast off your old coat and put on this."
With that, he put on Bilbo a small coat of mail, wrought for some young elf prince long ago. It was of silver steel, which the elves call mithril, and with it went a belt of pearls and crystals. A light helm of figured leather, strengthened beneath with hoops of steel, and studded about the brim with white gems, was set upon the hobbit's head.
"I feel magnificent," he thought. "But I expect I look rather absurd. How they would laugh on the hill at home. Still, I wish there was a looking-glass handy."
All the same, Mr. Baggins kept his head more clear of the bewitchment of the hoard than the dwarves did. long before the dwarves were tired of examining the treasures, he became weary of it and sat down on the floor. And he began to wonder nervously what the end of it all would be. "I'd give a good many of these precious goblets," he thought, "for a drink of something cheering out of one of Bjorn's wooden bowls." "Thorin," he cried aloud, "what next? We are armed, but what good has any armour ever been before against Smaug the dragon? This treasure is not yet won back. We are not looking for gold yet, but for a way of escape, and we've tempted luck too long."
"You speak the truth," answered Thorin, recovering his wits. "Let us go. I will guide you. Not in 1,000 years should I forget the ways of this palace."
Then he hailed the others, and they gathered together, and holding their torches above their heads, they passed through the gaping doors, not without many a backward glance of longing. Their glittering mail they had covered again with their old cloaks, and their bright helms with their tattered hoods, and one by one they walked behind Thorin, a line of little lights in the darkness that halted often, listening in fear once more for any rumour of the dragon's coming. Though all the old adornments were long moulded or destroyed, and though all was befouled and blasted with the comings and goings of the monster, Thorin knew every passage and every turn. They climbed long stairs, and turned and went down wide echoing ways, and turned again and climbed yet more stairs, and yet more stairs again. These were smooth, cut out of the living rock, broad and fair, and up, up the dwarves went, and they met no sign of any living thing, only furtive shadows that fled from the approach of their torches fluttering in the draughts. The steps were not made, all the same, for hobbit legs, and Bilbo was just feeling that he could go on no longer, when suddenly the roof sprang high and far beyond the reach of their torchlight. A white glimmer could be seen coming through some opening far above, and the air smelt sweeter. Before them light came dimly through great doors that hung twisted on their hinges and half-burnt.
"This is the great chamber of Thror," said Thorin, "the hall of feasting and of council. Not far off now is the front gate."
They passed through the ruined chamber. Tables were rotting there. Chairs and benches were lying there overturned, charred and decaying. Skulls and bones were upon the floor, among flagons and bowls and broken drinking horns and dust. As they came through yet more doors at the further end, a sound of water fell upon their ears, and the grey light grew suddenly more full.
"There is the birth of the running river," said Thorin. "From here it hastens to the gate. Let us follow it."
Out of a dark opening in a wall of rock, there issued a boiling water, and it flowed swirling in a narrow channel, carved and made straight and deep by the cunning of ancient hands. Beside it ran a stone-paved road, wide enough for many men abreast. Swiftly along this they ran, and round a wide-sweeping turn, and behold! Before them stood the broad light of day. In front there rose a tall arch, still showing the fragments of old carven work within, worn and splintered and blackened though it was. A misty sun sent its pale light between the arms of the mountain, and beams of gold fell on the pavements at the threshold. A whirl of bats, frightened from slumber by their smoking torches, flooded over them. As they sprang forward, their feet slithered on stones rubbed smooth and slimed by the passing of the dragon. Now before them the water fell noisily outward and foamed down towards the valley. They flung their pale torches to the ground and stood gazing out with dazzled eyes. They were come to the front gate and were looking out upon Dale.
"Well," said Bilbo, "I never expected to be looking out of this door, and I never expected to be so pleased to see the sun again, and to feel the wind on my face. But oh, this wind is cold.
It was. A bitter easterly breeze blew with a threat of oncoming winter. It swirled over and round the arms of the mountain into the valley, and sighed among the rocks. After their long time in the stewing depths of the dragon-haunted caverns, they shivered in the sun. Suddenly Bilbo realized that he was not only tired, but also very hungry indeed.
"It seems to be late morning," he said, "and so I suppose it's more or less breakfast time, if there's any breakfast to have. But I don't feel that Smaug's front doorstep is the safest place for a meal. Do let's go somewhere where we can sit quiet for a bit."
"Quite right," said Balin. "And I think I know which way we should go. We ought to make for the old lookout post at the southwest corner of the mountain."
"How far is that?" asked the hobbit.
5 hours' march, I should think. It will be rough going. The road from the gate along the left edge of the stream seems all broken up. But look down there.
The river loops suddenly east across Dale in front of the ruined town. At that point there was once a bridge, leading to steep stairs that climbed up the right bank and so to a road running towards Ravenhill. There is, or was, a path that left the road and climbed up to the post. A hard climb, too, even if the old steps are still there."
"Dear me," grumbled the hobbit.
"More walking and more climbing without breakfast. I wonder how many breakfasts and other meals we've missed inside that nasty, clockless, timeless hole."
As a matter of fact, 2 nights and the day between had gone by, and not altogether without food, since the dragon smashed the magic door. But Bilbo had quite lost count, and it might have been 1 night or a week of nights, for all he could tell.
"Come, come," said Thorin, laughing. His spirits had begun to rise again, and he rattled the precious stones in his pockets. "Don't call my place a nasty hole. You wait till it's been cleaned and redecorated."
"That won't be till Smaug's dead," said Bilbo glumly. "In the meantime, where is he? I would give a good breakfast to know. I hope he's not up on the mountain looking down at us."
That idea disturbed the dwarves mightily, and they quickly decided that Bilbo and Balin were right.
"We must move away from here," said Dorry. "I feel as if his eyes were on the back of my head." "It's a cold, lonesome place," said Bumba. "There may be drink, but I see no sign of food. A dragon would always be hungry in such parts."
"Come on, come on," cried the others. "Let us follow Balin's path."
Under the rocky wall to the right there was no path. So on they trudged among the stones on the left side of the river, and the emptiness and desolation soon sobered even Thorin again. The bridge that Balin had spoken of they found long fallen, and most of its stones were now only boulders in the shallow, noisy stream, but they forded the water without much difficulty, and found the ancient steps, and climbed the high bank. After going a short way, they struck the old road, and before long came to a deep dell sheltered among the rocks. There they rested for a while, and had such a breakfast as they could, chiefly cram and water. If you want to know what cram is, I can only say that I don't know the recipe, but it is biscuitish, keeps good indefinitely, is supposed to be sustaining, and is certainly not entertaining, being in fact very uninteresting, except as a chewing exercise. It was made by the lake men for long journeys. After that they went on again, and now the road struck westwards and left the river, and the great shoulder of the south-pointing mountain spur drew ever nearer. At length they reached the hill path. It scrambled steeply up, and they plodded slowly, one behind the other, till at last, in the late afternoon, they came to the top of the ridge and saw the wintry sun going downwards to the west.
Here they found a flat place without a wall on three sides, but backed to the north by a rocky face in which there was an opening like a door. From that door there was a wide view east and south and west.
Here, said Balin, in the old days we used always to keep watchmen, and that door behind leads into a rock-hewn chamber that was made here as a guard-room. There were several places like it round the mountain, but there seemed small need for watching in the days of our prosperity, and the guards were made over-comfortable, perhaps. Otherwise we might have had longer warnings of the coming of the dragon, and things might have been different. Still, here we can now lie hid and sheltered for a while, and can see much without being seen.
Not much use, if we've been seen coming here, said Dori, who was always looking up towards the mountain's peak, as if he expected to see Smaug perched there like a bird on a steeple.
We must take our chance of that, said Thorin. We can go no further today.
Here, here, cried Bilbo, and flung himself on the ground. In the rock chamber there would have been room for 100, and there was a small chamber further in, more removed from the cold outside. It was quite deserted. Not even wild animals seemed to have used it in all the days of Smaug's dominion. There they laid their burdens, and some threw themselves down at once and slept. But the others sat near the outer door and discussed their plans. In all their talk they came perpetually back to one thing. Where was Smaug? They looked west, and there was nothing. And east, and there was nothing. And in the south there was no sign of the dragon, but there was a gathering of very many birds. At that they gazed and wondered. But they were no nearer understanding it when the first cold stars came out.
Chapter 14. Fire and Water. Now, if you wish, like the dwarves, to hear news of Smaug, you must go back again to the evening when he smashed the door and flew off in rage 2 days before. The men of the lake town Esgaroth were mostly indoors, for the breeze was from the black east and chill, but a few were walking on the quays and watching, as they were fond of doing, the stars shine out from the smooth patches of the lake as they opened in the sky. From their town the lonely mountain was mostly screened by the low hills at the far end of the lake, through a gap in which the running river came down from the north. Only its high peak could they see in clear weather, and they seldom looked at it, for it was ominous and drear, even in the light of morning. Now it was lost and gone, blotted in the dark. Suddenly it flickered back to view. A brief glow touched it and faded.
"Look," said one, "the light again.
Last night the watchman saw them start and fade from midnight until dawn. Something's happening up there. Perhaps the king under the mountain is forging gold," said another. "It's long since he went north. It is time the songs began to prove themselves again."
"Which king?" said another with a grim voice. "As like as not it is the marauding fire of the dragon, the only king under the mountain we've ever known."
"You're always foreboding gloomy things," said the others. "Anything from floods to poisoned fish. Think of something cheerful."
Then suddenly a great light appeared in the low place in the hills, and the northern end of the lake turned golden.
"The king beneath the mountain," they shouted. "His wealth is like the sun, his silver like a fountain, his rivers golden run. The river is running gold from the mountain," they cried, and everywhere windows were opened and feet were hurrying. There was once more a tremendous excitement and enthusiasm, but the grim-voiced fellow ran hot-foot to the master. "The dragon is coming, or I'm a fool," he cried. "Cut the bridges! To arms! To arms!" Then warning trumpets were suddenly sounded, and echoed along the rocky shores.
The cheering stopped and the joy was turned to dread. So it was that the dragon did not find them quite unprepared. Before long, so great was his speed, they could see him as a spark of flashing towards them and growing ever huger and more bright, and not the most foolish doubted that the prophecies had gone rather wrong. Still, they had a little time. Every vessel in the town was filled with water. Every warrior was armed. Every arrow and dart was ready. And the bridge to the land was thrown down and destroyed before the roar of Smaug's terrible approach grew loud, and the lake rippled red as fire beneath the awful beating of his wings. Amid shrieks and wailing and the shouts of men, he came over them, swept towards the bridges, and was foiled. The bridge was gone, and his enemies were on an island in deep water, too deep and dark and cool for his liking. If he plunged into it, a vapour and a steam would arise enough to cover all the land with a mist for days. But the lake was mightier than he. It would quench him before he could pass through. Roaring, he swept back over the town. A hail of dark arrows leapt up and snapped and rattled on his scales and jewels, and their shafts fell back, kindled by his breath burning and hissing into the lake. No fireworks you ever imagined equaled the sights that night. At the twanging of the bows and the shrilling of the trumpets, the dragon's wrath blazed to its height, till he was blind and mad with it. No one had dared to give battle to him for many an age, nor would they have dared now, if it had not been for the grim-voiced man, Bard was his name, who ran to and fro cheering on the archers, and urging the master to order them to fight to the last arrow. Fire leapt from the dragon's jaws. He circled for a while, high in the air above them, lighting all the lake. The trees by the shores shone like copper and like blood, with leaping shadows of dense black at their feet. Then down he swooped straight through the arrow storm, reckless in his rage, taking no heed to turn his scaly sides towards his foes, seeking only to set their town ablaze. Fire leapt from thatched roofs and wooden beam ends as he hurtled down and past and round again, though all had been drenched with water before he came. Once more water was flung by a hundred hands wherever a spark appeared. Back swirled the dragon. A sweep of his tail, and the roof of the great house crumbled and smashed down. Flames unquenchable sprang high into the night. Another swoop, and another house, and then another sprang afire and fell, and still no arrow hindered Smaug, or hurt him more than a fly from the marshes.
This ends Disc 8.